Right. Welcome, everyone. Today I am broadcasting from our Zendo because we got internet access here this week, and my internet access at home just happened to go out. So it wasn't really the plan that I would show up here, but here I am. So it's kind of sweet, and it's gotten me thinking, and I rearranged the Zendo socially distanced, and we can fit 19 people. And I'm thinking, So Bob and I will be working on computers and cameras and laptops and all that so that we can keep everything accessible online. So stay tuned. And let's see, I will go around as usual and greet everyone, starting with Michael, Andoryu, Pat, Mark, Bob, Kay, that is, Paulette, Rosemary, Marv, Shoketsu, John, Mary, Alice, Randy, Peter, Katie, Abdullah, Tyler, Jim, Tierra, Bob O, Amelia, Sabrina, and Ruth Ann. All right. Nice group to have here. And now I'm thinking of all these ways that how are we going to keep, you know, online meaningful when we, what we usually do when we're in person at the Zendo is everyone introduces themselves at this point. They say their name and then everybody repeats their name. So you kind of get to learn people's names. So we'll probably do something like that. And then we'll have to do the Zoom people too. So let's see, in terms of announcements, June 27th, is it, will be our Jukai ceremony. And that's where I think about 7 people will be receiving the precepts and formally becoming Buddhist. That will be streamable online. And we will also have, that will probably be our first like in-person event, where the people who are going to be here in person, a couple people are flying in and one person is local, will be here physically for the ceremony, but then there will be a number of people receiving the precepts who will be remote as well. So they have to recruit somebody in their life to participate in the ceremony, to put their wagesa over their head as my proxy. So you don't put it over your own head. Somebody else has to be involved. So I figured that was the basics. So that should be very sweet. So please try to be here on June 27th. It'll be in place. It'll be at this time of day, right? This in place of the Dharma talk. I apologize if the audio isn't quite as great as usual. I don't have a lapel mic that works with this laptop yet, but we'll be working on that. And also our August session. So there will be an August retreat. Well, I guess it's not, I don't like really like to call it a session when we are not, it's not a residential thing. So I'm just calling it a retreat. But anyway, in August 23rd through the 28th, so that's a Monday evening through a Saturday morning, and it will be, we will have some limited in-person participation here, and but also online. So I highly encourage you, if you're able to set aside that week or part of that week in order to spend time in silence and meditation and with Sangha, that be very, generally a very wonderful practice. All right, any questions or additional things that I should announce? All right. So today, my talk, I'm calling it Ennobling Our Lives by Engaging All Problems as Koans. So I'll talk about what koans are and all that. And by ennoble means to lend greater dignity or nobility of character to. Noble meaning having fine personal qualities or high moral principles or ideals of excellent or superior quality. Dignity being the state or quality of being worthy of honor or respect. So the idea of ennobling our lives is, I don't know, it's kind of like, I think most of us, I mean, sometimes we feel kind of discouraged or depressed or something, but for the most part, I think we're like, well, we're decent, you know, we're okay, we're doing our best. But this is kind of even above and beyond that, is how do we see our lives, frame our lives, live our lives in a way that is not just, you know, good enough, not worthy of criticism, but actually worthy of honor and respect. So I forget exactly where it's from, but my teacher, Gyokuko, really would often repeat the phrase, our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. So this is a very central idea in Mahayana Buddhism and Zen, that this is how our true nature is. So when we have a problem, when we have an obstruction, when we have frustration, a limitation, conflict, inhibition, anxiety, etc., this is seen as something getting in the way of our true nature. So this is very different than a sense of like we have a flawed, you know, true flawed nature that needs to be purified, but that we have this pure nature, and if we're having issues feeling like that or manifesting that, something is getting in the way. So there's several premises from behind what I'm going to talk about today. The idea that whenever we experience a contraction, fear, inhibition, grasping, confusion, dullness, it's a place where our true nature is being obscured. And no matter how mundane the problem, if you trace the why back to its source, you will find a spiritual issue. Whether it's addiction or laziness or judgmentalism or snappiness or stinginess or anything like that, that if you trace it far enough back to its source, it's a spiritual issue. And therefore, every contraction is an opportunity for learning and greater freedom. Engaging any and all of our problems this way is what we call koan work in the Soto sense. Now, in the Rinzai sense, there's classical koan stories. They're teaching stories of an interaction between a teacher and a student, which portray a certain kind of spiritual issue and its resolution. So there's these classical stories, and in Rinzai, they have been collected into collections, literary collections, which we study in Soto as well. But in Rinzai, mm-hmm. they systematically go through those koans. So you get assigned one and you work on it and you work on another one and stuff like that. So they're very systematic about it. Whereas Soto is more, we include those stories in our literature and our teaching, but we don't work through them in this systematic way. Instead, we emphasize that koans arise in everyday life. So when you're studying one of these teaching stories, in order to work with it in the Rinzai way, you have to connect with it personally anyway. you have to explore what this story is and find out what's going on here, what spiritual issue is being discussed, and you have to find a way to make it alive for yourself. So we say is, you know, this arises in your everyday life. And so basically we just have to learn how to see the conflicts in our life, the issues in our life as koans and engage them that way. So inherent in any koan is the promise that clarity, understanding, resolution, peace, and greater freedom is possible. It's right there within our grasp. And because every problem we encounter is a koan waiting for us to engage it and resolve it, that's where I feel like our entire lives are ennobled. So problems, when we say problems, let's look for the problems in your life. That might be a loaded term and encourage some shame. Like, what's the main focus of Zen? It's like, well, what kind of problems do you have? Let's look at your problems. And maybe that's why maybe we should just call them koans or challenges or something, opportunities. So it's difficult to explain to people. I know I've mentioned this a number of times. I've mentioned it in passing on the podcast. I mention it sometimes in a Dharma talk that, you know, we want to engage our lives in this way. We want to engage our lives and investigate these issues and learn. But it's difficult to convey this in the abstract, which is why we have all those koan teaching stories to say, here's an example. This is what we mean. So this is why I was thrilled to discover recently, like within the last week or two, a new book. So this is called The Book of Householder Koans, Waking Up in the Land of Attachments by Eve Mionin Marco and Wendy Igyoku Nakao.
Kachu, 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 Mr. Kachu.
I can share the information on that book later if you want to try to track it down. So it has over 60 koan stories drawn from modern lay lives, from real people. Presumably the names have been changed a little bit, right? But I get a sense they're from real people, real students of these teachers. And even though these stories are much easier to relate to, and I'm going to share one of them today, than classic koan stories, we still need to engage them in order to benefit from them much. So that's why I think this is such a rich resource. So you might read them and it might evoke something, or you might think, oh, that's kind of neat. But the koan work is really still, it's investigation. Engaging in an issue with a determination to break through it, resolve it, wake up to a new way of understanding or being. So I'm just going to say a few more things about kind of koan work in the Soto sense in general before we go into a particular one. So just this sense of approaching our life as if every contraction we encounter is a koan, everything. But trying to avoid the sense that like we're obligated to solve all of our problems. So this isn't a self-improvement project or fuel for some sense of inadequacy or guilt or basis for comparing ourselves to others or some ideal. Many of us are going, any practice that we adopt, we're going to start using that way at some point. So we just need to remind ourselves that that's not the point. So it's not a matter of, you know, every issue you have is a koan you need to solve. And like, if you don't solve it, you're lazy and, you know, incomplete or something like that. This is just about Buddhism's message of hope, which I think we can track all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, who discovered. So his question was, you know, the human experience is so changeable, right? We're inevitably going to face old age, disease, and death, and loss, and and facing things that we don't want to encounter. So he said, what can we do about it other than just being buffeted about by the winds of fate? Is there anything we can do for a certain kind of sense or peace or stability? And he found that no matter what's happening, your experience is largely dependent on the state of your own mind and heart. To me, that kind of, for me, that sums up Buddhism. And so this Zen koan approach is just kind of an evolution of this original Buddhist understanding. You get a conundrum in your sights, a contraction, an obstacle, a limitation, a point of discomfort, pain, frustration, or even just more subtly, a point of tension. Noticing where resistance comes up in you. For instance, something that I think many of you are aware of that I'm working on is like, if you think that we are on the brink of climate catastrophe, how do you not freak out about that at every moment, right? How do you let that go in Zazen? That's a point of tension when I go like, no, I don't want to do that. That's not okay. Or what if I just lived my life without identifying with what it is that I do? What if I just lived? Like, well, you know, so you notice a resistance sometimes in yourself to a certain way of being, a certain idea or something. Like, huh, what is that? So you get this in your sights. And once that question is raised, you usually can't just sit down and figure it out. It's not a matter of like, now you've kind of identified a koan in your life. Why do you act a certain way, whatever? You can't just like sit down and zazen and like figure it out one session. You can't bash it down or force it to change by sheer force of will. The way we might attack ordinary problems. With koans, you have to get up close to it and investigate it, but with a sense of humility and patience. So it's always about trying to find a question. What is going on here? A question along with a willingness to know, a willingness to learn, and perhaps discover uncomfortable truths about ourselves and the way that we've been living or the assumptions that we're holding. But ultimately with the gain of greater freedom. So the idea of the koan work is like you can, I hesitate to say figure it out, but you can break through, you can resolve, something can shift and change and bring greater freedom. So the way that my teacher Kyogen would describe this is, his metaphors were always very effective, but not very elegant. So anyway, he said, it's like you found a door and now you're just gonna keep your hand on the door. You're not gonna try to like bash down the door, but you're not gonna walk away from it either. You're going to keep your hand on it and then just see if there's an opportunity to push or something shifts. So you stay connected with the question. So the tricky part, of course, is recognizing the koans in our lives as koans. And I'll probably need to say more about this in the future, but I think this book helps us imagine what they look like. Because a lot of times the kinds of things that I'm talking about, the kinds of things that are koans, we usually think of as something that's just annoying. We blame others, we blame the world, or we blame some flaw in ourselves. And we think unless that changes, unless that person changes or that situation changes or this aspect of myself changes, this is going to be a problem. And we wish it, you know, the wish it wasn't like this. But the teaching says that there is something that we can shift in our own understanding or relationship to the world that can bring relief, can bring wisdom and greater compassion and greater freedom, regardless of what changes externally or even internally, if we're thinking of a personal flaw. So enough talking in the abstract. I'm going to share a koan from this book. So this is chapter 3. It's called Lori. This is it. So this period is period it period. So koans, and the way they've traditionally, and they followed this structure in this book as well, it usually has a verse and then the koan case itself and then some commentary. So the verse for this one is, when sharp thorns prick you, go straight on. When prodded relentlessly, go straight on. When your partner doesn't get you, go straight on. When you come to a crossroad, take it. So here's the koan. Lori and Kathy were retired. Kathy did not hesitate to show her disdain for the time that Lori spent down there at the Zen Center. Each time Lori would leave the house, Kathy, from her perch on the sofa, would say, "There she goes down there again." One Friday evening, Lori, laden with luggage from her days away, crossed the threshold into the house. Kathy, still sitting on the sofa, asked, "Well, Lori, have you found the meaning of life yet?" Without hesitation, Lori replied, "Yes, Kathy, this is it." Kathy was silent. So I'm going to read a little bit of the commentary and then make some commentary myself. So reflection, the way of Zen is indeed mysterious, its practice even more so to those who are not so inclined. Have you ever fallen short when you tried to explain why you practice Zen or any spiritual practice, sometimes sounding even more self-absorbed than usual? It can be so challenging to your partner when the way-seeking heart arises. Until that is, your practice takes root and you become a better partner. Who is the old woman in your life? Who's saying, they quoted a story where the old woman is, so this, in this case, Kathy sitting on the couch is like the old woman who challenges the practitioner. Like, what are you doing? So who is the old woman in your life? Put aside for a time whether you think she or he is enlightened or not. The old woman in Lori's house would prod her. There she goes, down there again to the Zen Center. How many times have you heard these kinds of remarks from your partner or family member or whatever? There he goes again. And me, look, I'm home taking care of the kids, doing the yard work and washing his clothes. So what is going on here in this story? You may relate very directly to this story. I know there are many people, I mean, because what we tend, Western communities like this tend to be predominantly people who have chosen to practice in this way. And that usually means that friends and family and spouses and whatever aren't Buddhist or Zen, or they don't particularly relate. So you may have loved ones who don't understand what you're doing, why you're online right now. They may resist or resent or just quietly disparage. Or maybe they're supportive. They're supportive as they can be, but they just don't get it. Just, okay, you spend your time sitting Zazen or studying the Dharma or spending time with Sangha. And it seems in some ways, perhaps to them, like the equivalent of a hobby. Like, okay, you know, maybe you might be into fishing or knitting or whatever. When, you know, for many of us, our practice is much more important to us than that. It's central. It's essential to our functioning and embracing our life wholeheartedly. If a loved one, however, is openly hostile, why do we persist? Should we? If we're creating disharmony in our home life or family, we'd better have a good reason. Zen suggests practice is our everyday life, no different from our everyday life. So why would we create disharmony there? Why would we take energy away from the rest of our life to do this? Is it selfish? So koan work involves peeling back layers of questions, like layers of an onion. And each of these questions we explore for ourselves. So any particular formulation I might have mentioned may or may not resonate with you or mean anything to you. But when we're exploring a koan, it's a question that when we happen upon it, we go, oh, there's something there. There's something there for me. And we explore it for ourselves, and there's no right or wrong answer. We just have to look within and be willing to find out what's going on. And without judgment or editing or denial. Like sometimes, you know, we argue with ourselves like, well, that's not fair, or that's a stupid thought, or that's a selfish thought, or that's a whatever. And in so doing, it's much more difficult to actually see what is going on. Whereas, you know, quietly within, we can ask these questions and realize, okay, you know, maybe some of the thoughts in there are pretty judgmental or uncharitable or irrational or anything, but that's just what is. So that's where we begin. We may find, in this particular example, for instance, we may find judgment of our loved ones or friends that don't understand. Like they're just, you know, incapable of practice, or they don't have those deeper questions or something like that. Or we may find doubt about our own choices. Am I doing the right thing? Is this selfish? Is this fair? What is going on? We may find a need for affirmation, approval from people, or an aversion to any kind of conflict in our lives. So once we see something, the process doesn't end there. That's just the first layer of the onion. Now what's going on at this level? What's below it? Why is that? Why does it matter what your loved one thinks? Why are we not entirely confident in our choices about our practice? Why the need for affirmation? What's wrong with a low level of ongoing conflict in your life? Is it going to kill you? What, you know, exploring what's beneath that. Perhaps in the next layer, you'll find a stubborn determination to practice as you damn well want to. Who knows? There are more questions. So I'm going to read a little bit more from this, from the commentary. What was Lori seeking? What are you seeking? One might think that for Lori, retired with a comfortable income and her own home, there would be no need to seek for anything more. Certainly her partner thought so. So what propels one person to sit on a meditation cushion for hours and another to sit on the sofa all day? Which one are you? How did you become as you are? I think this is a brilliantly written book. The questions just kind of make a shiver run down my spine, right? It's not, that is where the wisdom and the opening is coming from, these questions, not from, you know, any particular answer I might give or that you even might give at this moment. What about that? So underneath what seems, in all aspects of our life, underneath what might seem like a mundane interpersonal issue, there's the whole question of the nature of Buddhist practice and our motivation and what are we seeking? And if we already have it, why do we need to seek for it? And yet we do need to seek for it. We do need to, some of us anyway, feel the need to sit zazen and to study the Dharma and to spend time with Sangha. Why do we feel the need for that when our life is already complete? We're stuck between a rock and a hard place. If we give up practicing, something is missing. When we push against the circumstances of our lives in order to practice, we create a new problem. What can we do? So koan stories contain, this is part of their brilliance, they contain an example of breaking through, of awakening, of resolution, in order to inspire us. So this is the promise, right? If you engage this issue, if you engage this question, whatever it is, a tendency you have to shy away from challenge, a dullness or a laziness and an inability to stay connected with your true passion, or the list goes on. You might think it's just a mundane issue. But this says, if you engage this in a deep way and you keep your hand on the door, you keep your eye on the ball, resolution is possible. There is an answer, although it's not an answer that necessarily you're going to be able to put into words. It's not an answer that's necessarily going to make any sense to anybody else. But at some point, you're going to recognize, oh, I've been hoping for this, but that's not something that I really need. Or, I've been afraid of this, but actually it'd be more fulfilling to live without that fear. You know, it's some kind of little enlightenment that we experience. So the koan promises us that. And in the story is a story of someone's awakening. So, in the story, this is the one we're studying here. This is the commentary on Lori's awakening. As she plunged deeper into meditation, Lori learned to traverse the thicket of who she was and to come to peace within herself. You could say that her inner old woman had been satisfied. But as there was no let up at home, she had to wrestle with the old woman sitting on her sofa. And resentments considerably, and finally, her defenses and resentments considerably softened. She found herself in a healing acceptance of her partner and their situation together. And so it was that one night when Lori stepped through the threshold of their abode and the old woman asked again, "So, Lori, have you found the true meaning of life yet?" Lori responded from the depths of this mystery, "Yes, this is it." So you could read, if you're just looking at the words, you could read, "This is it," right? You could say, she's saying, "All right, if you keep harassing me about going to the Zen Center, this is over. I'm ending this relationship." You could read, "This is it," as, "I don't need to go to the Zen Center anymore. This home, this is it." But I don't think it's either one of those things, right? Lori didn't stop practicing. She didn't leave her partner or tell her to shut up. And her partner probably didn't stop giving her a hard time about going to the Zen Center. So what's going on here? What's the manner of this resolution? I like to think in this. So it's like it's this period, is period, it, this. What is this? This is Lori. This is her way-seeking mind. This is her practice. This is her resentful partner. This is their relationship, which presumably has rewarding aspects as well as frustrating aspects. This is ongoing challenges. This is unresolved koans, unfairness. This is the inevitability of old age, disease, and death. And the fact that no matter how hard we try to prepare for them, we won't be as ready as we hope. So this is I face all of this openly, fearlessly, honestly, without denial or uselessly wishing it was otherwise. And it with a capital I, the completeness, the nobility, the dignity that we long for, it. So I like to think that what's portrayed here is Lori making a fierce and vital peace with her life, standing upright in her choices without apology, without defensiveness, and therefore with compassion and patience. Will she be able to keep that position, that freedom? Maybe, maybe the next week. Not so much. But generally speaking, when we resolve a koan for ourselves, we are forever changed. And I think probably everyone here has some example that some shift in your mind and heart that, you continue to have the challenge. It doesn't solve all your problems, but that never entirely goes away. That different way of seeing, that different way of being. So I'll leave it there. Open it up for comments and questions. Go ahead and unmute yourself if you want to say something, or raise your hand electronically is the easiest way. If you just go down to reactions, you can choose a raised hand feature. Shoketsu.
Could you, Domio, repeat what you opened with? Our true nature is something that Gyokoko said to you. Our
true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. I got to look it up now, right? I just didn't have time today. I think it's, more or less a paraphrase probably from the Lotus Sutra or something like that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Tyler.
Yeah, hi. I guess I don't know if it's a question, but I found it really interesting because I was doing my first retreat earlier this month. I think it was this month. Oh, goodness. And I'd kind of been avoiding them because I felt this pressure of should I be taking all this time to myself to be practicing Zen, and I don't want to leave all this work for my partner. And I was kind of avoiding it. I kind of created the opposite problem of my partner being oh my God, you're projecting all this stuff onto me. all these old woman things on me. He's go do it. This is something I want you to, but I was avoiding it. And she started feeling I was thinking these things about her, but it was just sort of this funny but it is that sort of, and what I was thinking of, the old lady is this internal thing, right? It's not necessarily this other person on the couch, but this other person inside me being you don't really have time to spend this on yourself. Is this really that important to you? And it turns out it is, but I was sort of avoiding it. But I think having that internal argument, but I guess my partner felt I was projecting that on the rest of the family, and they were all go. God, you're not causing us any sort of stress. So I just thought it was an interesting, a really interesting story, given my kind of work through this over the last month.
Yeah, I think it's, there's so many different directions and levels you could go to with this, right? And I think she did mention, Lori had to deal with her own inner old woman. And I, guess to some extent at a subtle level, that's like, that's a resistance to sitting, you know, that we kind of feel like we can't let go of everything. What are we doing just sitting here being useless? There's a little kind of voice inside that, oh, there's so much stuff we should be doing, such a list of unfinished projects or responsibilities. And Franklin.
It was interesting when I heard the statement when she said, this is it. I took that really quite literally, like, you know, the meaning of life is exactly what this situation is. In other words, she's got to this place of acceptance of whatever conflict or whatever is going on with her partner. And that's life, right? Like, I didn't think of anything, all these other things, is that was it. Like, that's how, you know, in a nutshell, that experience is really kind of a metaphor for all of life, really. So that was my take.
But it's like, what, you know, for somebody who wasn't familiar with practice, right? Those same words could be discouraging. You know, it's like, here you go, here's this conflict, here's my life, God, I'm trying. And, you know, something's like, well, this is it. Be like, oh. but we know, you know, and I think what you're pointing at is like, it has a different flavor. It's this is it in a way that is affirming and okay. And like, what else do you need to look for? Which is, you know, it's not that easy. Paulette.
Yeah, I was thinking like Franklin, like this is it, this is the practice. But I always question why in the, you know, traditional Buddha story, why Buddha left his wife and child. You know, like, is part of the practice the balancing of being a householder and, you know, sitting on the cushion? Or is it, you know, is it giving all of that up and the hardship of that to pursue, you know, the monastic life or even more of a monastic life? You know, I always kind of, that was always like a koan for me, because I'm like, what, he left, but how did that leave his wife and child? And I'm sure other people have thought about this, but, you know, so I guess that's the questions that I have about this topic.
That's an awesome question. I didn't even think about connecting this particular koan to that, but it's like, I think that's what these kind of koan stories do, is like they end up pointing you toward a conundrum, right? It's like, okay, I'm finding this tradition and this practice helpful and meaningful, and yet it was founded by a guy who like deserted his family. Like, what is that about? Like, is that something I'm supposed to do, or was that actually not good? What? So as we struggle with that, it's like I actually had to face that question in a very, very literal way. So, you know, I began practice as a lay person in 95, and I was married and I was getting my master's degree, and I was, you know, I had a car and I had pets and I had everything. And this longing arose within me to like go away to a monastery, to put it all down, to just devote myself entirely to this path. But like I was wrestling with myself, right? You're like, you shouldn't need to do that. Like kind of the highest, like you should just be able to like do that balance and do it in the midst of your life. And so it actually felt like a weakness, right? That I would ditch my responsibilities, that I would go away with self-indulgent, all this stuff. So I was struggling with it. And so I asked my teacher, because she went away to a monastery and she was married when she went in, and she and her husband both went in, but then they ended up getting divorced. And then she ended up marrying Kyogen, who was at the monastery. Anyway, she went away to a monastery. She had made that choice. So I asked her, you know, why did she do it? You know, like, is there something I'm missing here? Some reason why I should conclude this is a good thing to do? This is justified, whatever. And she said, because that's where I was most happy. And I was like, what? What? Like, what kind of answer is that? This is like, but you know, this isn't about like self-indulgence, right? Where what I'm most, so I thought that was a very, you know, that was like in a way, like she gave me a koan there. Like, what? That's where I'm most happy. And I ended up leaving. I ended up ditching everything. I've gotten everything back over the years, but I did leave everything. And all I can figure is like, it wasn't the right thing to do. It wasn't justified. It was just what I had to do. It's what I had to do, you know? So how do we clarify within ourselves what we have to do? What is our way? You know, can't just listen to somebody else. Can't just follow what the tradition says. You know, there may be people in this Sangha who it's like, if you really followed your heart, you would get rid of everything and go to a monastery. But, you know, for many other people, it's like, no, I am going to do it here and honor my commitments. let's see. So I have, I'm not sure who was first, Brian or Michael, and it looks like Ruth Ann might want to talk as well. So who's first, Brian or Michael? Brian?
Well, yeah, I'll go first because I'm going to stay on Tyler's superficial level, which was the... You know, my partner is thrilled because I'm a much better guy than, you know, and I'm just more thoughtful, less reactive, you know, all of that. And so, you know, she might up for some additional time. I'm not sure, but at any rate, that was my superficial reaction to the koan.
Well, and that's what I remember Kyogen and Gyokoko saying, like, the measure of your practice, you know, if you, assuming you have relationships and a family and whatever, that the measure of your practice shouldn't be, you know, whatever, how many realizations you have or how deep your meditation is, but has it made you a better spouse or father or daughter or whatever? Has it made you better? Do the people in your life go, I mean, you know, they may still resent the time, but you know, that's really the measure of it. It's like, how do we manifest it?
And I was thinking also, I listened to your Zen podcast on the connection between Zen or Buddhism and social action. And I thought it related to that as well, because I feel like I'm better at that as well. I know it's a, you know, it's not quite the connection that some other faith traditions, you know, have to social action, but I think it's an important one. So,
yeah, it has a lot to offer. Michael?
That question about the Buddha has long bothered me. and I guess the best that I could have been able to tell myself was, number one, well, it was 2,500 years ago and things were much different. And the result of what he did has changed a lot of lives. So maybe it was all worthwhile, but yet it's still something that in a way is hard to deal with because he just walked away.
And even if he achieved something amazing by walking away, does that mean we need to walk away ultimately in order to achieve the same thing? Which, you know, the original Buddhism seemed to suggest kind of yes and no. It had perfect examples of lay people who were deeply realized, but it did acknowledge, like, if you want to go all the way, which of us really, like, thinks that we're going to go all the way, right? We're not really worried about that too much. Halfway would be fine. So, but if you're going to go all the way, that you needed to leave home. And the, you know, when I think about my own life and like the, I'm just involved in so many things and I have so many projects. And the when you get involved, you care. You care about the projects, you care about the people, you're invested. There's just no way around it. Like it, unless you went, you know, you're just going about your business half-heartedly, you care. And that it's more difficult. It's more difficult to sit on the cushion and let go when you have all of those things that you're invested in. It's just more difficult. But I mean, I don't want to let any of my stuff go. This is the life that I want to lead. So in a way, even if it's more challenging to let go in the midst of all of this, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to learn how to do. I don't want to, you know, go away and ditch everything again. Ah, big question. Marv.
I just thought I'd offer another take on that issue of Buddha leaving home with a wife and child. The ancient societies I've studied in Latin America, it was typical for even boy children under the age of 7 to be in exclusively with the women of the family. It wasn't like a nuclear family idea. All the women of the family did women's work together. All the men of the family did men's work together. And about age 7, the boy would move to be associated with the men and learn the skills that the men needed in that family. And coincidentally, Rahula was exactly age 7 when he joined the Buddha and the Buddha became his teacher. The Buddha taught him the skills that were now his trade. So just another take.
Interesting, yeah. Tiara?
Yeah, another thing to add some context to the Buddha question, wasn't it at that time too Theravada Buddhism versus Mahayana? So it's, and I believe the translation is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like the lesser, the smaller and the bigger vehicle, or the lesser and the larger vehicle, and the kind of difference, the differentiation being about the transcendence for oneself, being the more Theravada tradition versus Mahayana is for, you know, all sentient beings. So the consciousness of all. So it is kind of a question of why he left his wife and his kids. Was it because it was about his journey to his transcendence, or was it about the transcendence for all sentient beings? Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting thing. And then also, like as a more modern context, maybe it's also why there was a split later, like in Japan, Jodo Shinshu Buddhism basically is about being able to practice as a lay person, not having to leave all of your normal lifestyle. So maybe somebody in the past or Shinran Shonen had that same question as, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but Sato, I think was your last, Paulette, maybe they had the same question. Shinran Shonen had the same question and came up with Jodo Shinshu Buddhism because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Yes, thank you. What Marv mentioned about the change for male children going with the older adults, males. That's in African cultures as well. I think Buddha had a destiny, and the last Sangha member sharing, I think that fits. For me, I don't feel, I don't know, the last 20 years, I needed to justify whatever time I spent meditating. And now the 2.5 years is sitting. So then I cannot not do it, even if I perhaps one day or so miss it. But I'm not the only person on the planet that is happy with the koan you just mentioned, this is it, because there are those of us that have a loved one who's under some life-threatening illness, addiction of some type that, you know, I bring it to my practice, but I fully accept, detach from whatever outcome, because this is it. And it's not because I'm this age, but sat with that grace for decades. So as I say, I'm not the only person on the planet to kind of walks that path. So I'm grateful for Right Way to have this Sangha. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, the yeah, I think it's a very interesting that we've discussed like the most concrete and extreme example of kind of like leaving home, right? The Buddha's story. But then also, of course, it goes all the way to the subtle of, you know, just taking time out of our lives for Zazen, making space, recognizing when you have to say no to things, when, you know, voluntary simplicity might be a good thing, that you need to take more, you know, space for yourself, or I don't know, like these kinds of choices that put end up putting us up against perhaps what we think is right or what other people think is right. I think that's how do we make these decisions for ourselves? And I would say that we're never, unfortunately, Buddhism never gives us a resting place. I mean, it doesn't. It's like resting in the midst of all of it, right? But it never gives us a place where like, okay, got that one solved. Now I know that, you know, I can dedicate 7.5 hours a week to Zen, and that's legit, and I never have to visit the question again. You know, it's like we have to continually engage. It's never 100% right or wrong. Paulette, did you have something else to add?
No, I was just going to say in the Tibetan tradition, I have a teacher who, the Sakya Treason, who is married with children who are continuing the lineage. So, you know, maybe that's another aspect of the story, is that he wanted to have a son to continue the lineage. I don't know. I don't know too much about the son.
And just on one last little thing about kind of the renunciate lifestyle, I personally find, you know, complete renunciates, and I would, you know, the classic example I'm thinking of is fully ordained Theravadan monks and nuns who live according to 250 plus precepts. They don't own anything besides their own robes and their begging bowl. They're not married. They don't have sex. They don't, you know, watch TV, they don't handle money, all of this stuff. And it's like, to me, it's a deeply inspiring and beautiful exploration and example of how life can be complete and rewarding, even without all the stuff. Because we may suspect that's the case, but we don't really know, right? We haven't given up our stuff. So we can say, I don't think I really need it. But like, there's just a little part of us that can't know unless we actually give up all our stuff. And I feel like those examples of people, and they're happy, right? They're at peace. They're complete. They're generous. So there's some people in the world, I'm glad some people in the world live like that, you know, to ground and inspire the rest of us. All right, it is time. We'll close with the verse, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dalmio.
Thank you.
Have a good week. Bye-bye.